Coming to you from the tiny city inside your computer, it's the Liberal Arts,
a podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Ressa. And that's how the podcast goes.
Thanks for tuning in today.
Cleo, you said that your fun fact would confuse us.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's going to be confusing, just that it's incredibly random.
It'll probably be less confusing than the spiel I went on last time, so shoot.
My fun fact today is about teeth.
Teeth? I've got those.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm happy for you.
I'm kind of nervous.
So I saw a picture on the internet of a billboard that said possums have the most teeth of any mammal.
Wow.
You got weird Nightvalian billboards where you live, don't you?
Yeah.
I find that hard to believe. I would have suspected some aquatic mammal before possums.
Well, I wrote this down because I was like, that's kind of fun fact worthy. It said they have 50 teeth, and that's the most of any mammal. So I googled this today.
I am suspicious.
I was also suspicious. So I turned to the one true fountain of information. The internet.
Google?
Yes.
Nice.
And I googled
Excellent.
It.
Excellent.
They should know if anyone does.
I discovered during my googling that this was an incorrect billboard.
Lies,
shock,
deception.
And that possums do not have the most teeth of any mammal. Actually, it really depends on whether we're talking about land or aquatic mammals.
Was I right?
Oh, you were right.
Is it an aquatic mammal that has the most teeth?
I believe yes. So I found
I'm
this.
So smart.
I found this wonderful website by a dentist office that has a help page full of tooth trivia, and I learned some very interesting and somewhat frightening things, like the fact that mosquitoes have teeth.
Ooh.
Ah, what? No!
Why would you tell me this?
Yeah, mosquitoes have teeth. Sleep well. But the land mammal with the most teeth is the giant armadillo.
What?
Yeah. It can have as many as 100 teeth. And the aquatic
Why?
The aquatic mammal with the most teeth is the spinner dolphin, which can have as many as 252 teeth. But neither of these compare to the animal class that has the most teeth of any animals in all the world.
Oh, wait, let's guess.
Yeah.
Sharks.
No.
It's gonna be something surprising. It'll be like a bug or like... No, it'll be like a goose or something. Like those weird teeth on their tongues. Ugh. Ugh. What is it?
It's snails.
What? No.
Mollusks have the most teeth of any animal group in the world.
They don't have teeth.
Between 2,000 to 15,000 micro teeth.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well, sure, micro teeth.
They don't.
I'm gonna
chew
have to go Google snail teeth.
They don't chew with them. They use them to like scrape micro. According to this website on the internet, they use them to scrape rocks for microalgae.
Oh, I looked it up and I regret it. Don't Google it, people.
Like,
don't do it.
No, okay, no. On the contrary, we are posting a picture.
No.
So...
Because now I have to know.
According to this website, the School of Engineering at the University of Portsmouth in Great Britain did a study, and these teeth have a resistance almost similar to the strongest materials ever produced by man.
What?
So,
Heck.
Dang.
There's your fun fact for the day. Snails.
What's the strongest thing around?
Cool.
Snail teeth.
Snail
cool,
teeth.
Cool. I am uncomfortable by this with this conversation, just in general.
Mm-hmm. Also, according...
Also, I feel the urgent need to go to the dentist.
And
the
get some salt.
To the great trivia. To get some salt. Oh my gosh.
How do your snail teeth do with this, huh?
According to the wonderful trivia website of Dr. Mark George, the dentist from somewhere... I don't really know.
Thanks for listening, Mark George. Thank big you. Fan of the podcast, I know.
Dr. Mark George. yeah, just lots and lots of fun teeth facts on there. Also facts about tongues, but,
Should I start the colloquium before anything else horrible happens?
You may now bring us on to more productive material.
So, now that we've had this conversation, who needs a drink?
Me.
Oh, hey, that's timely, isn't it? So, yeah, today we are going to return to our tourist guide to Prohibition. And, you know how I said this was going to be a two-part series?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's a three-part series.
Cool. So, did the history of Prohibition get longer?
More beer.
I think it's less beer.
You might be surprised.
Oh, good.
So, shall we begin the colloquium?
Please, whisk us away to the year, what is it? I've already forgotten.
1920.
Thank you.
So when we had last left our story, the 18th Amendment had been voted into law by a state convention. And it banned the sale, importation, and the production of alcohol in the United States. Law went into effect at the stroke of midnight on January 16th, 1920.
Now, how many people got hammered that night, right before midnight?
Oh, we'll get there.
Just drink.
Don't worry.
It. Okay.
We will get there. But first, I want to talk about a little bit about the law itself. The enforcement of this law was something called the Volstead Act, which was passed by Congress. And it basically, it made necessary federal decisions to enforce prohibition, and also specified that the 18th Amendment banned sale, importation, and production. Incidentally, did not ban the drinking of alcohol.
Nice.
Yeah.
So if you can get it, you can drink it.
So everyone buy now.
Well, that was the thing, is people started stockpiling. Rich people, like, started buying out the stocks and warehouses of bars and beer companies. Some alcohol production did happen during Prohibition. It was for... the Volstead Act had a dispensation for alcohol use, quote, for scientific research and in the development of fuel, dye, and other lawful industries and practices, okay, such as religious rituals. They had a specific amount of wine that was made in the U.S. specifically for priests to use for communion wine.
Okay.
Well, that's nice.
Priests and pastors. Yeah, so there was that. Didn't always get used for communion, but...
Gasp.
Sacrilege. I know, shocking. In preparation for Prohibition, people started stockpiling liquor because it was not illegal to have liquor. So, okay. Incidentally... Woodrow Wilson and Warren G. Harding both had stockpiles of liquor in the White House. They brought it with them. That's when amazing. Warren G. Harding was sworn in, he brought with him his liquor stash.
Smart man? I mean...
Mm-hmm. Then people started stealing and hiding distillery equipment, or buying it off from defunct beer companies. So, like... that people would be, like, walking off with distillation setups to install in their backyard and things. And then the beer companies themselves, you know, they had to stay in business. So they started developing something called, and you guys have to tell me if you've ever had anything like this, okay? It's called near beer.
Near beer?
Oh, I think I have, actually.
It's non-alcoholic beer. Please, yes, Rissa, yeah. Tell us about your experience.
Oh, it's just not good.
And Cleo.
It just does not taste good. I don't like it.
It's
now,
disgusting.
I mean, some people drink it. I have a friend who likes it. It's not good. I have had both non-alcoholic beer and also gluten-free beer, and I am not a fan of either of them.
What about you, Cleo?
I have had non-alcoholic beer, and it is not good. Mm-mm. It's actually a very popular drink in Lithuania.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Was not expecting this.
I mean, actual beer is also a very popular drink in Lithuania. I mean, but
that's not surprising though, because beer is
a non-alcoholic version called Gita, and it's not good. And pretty much everyone on my study abroad team claimed to have fallen in love with it while they were there. Mm-mm. And either they have very odd taste buds or they were lying.
Well, you guys might agree with 1920s food critic Waverly Root. He called near beer such a wishy-washy, thin, ill-tasting, discouraging sort of slop that it might have been dreamed up by a Puritan Machiavelli with the intent of disgusting drinkers with genuine beer forever.
Yes! That was amazing.
Waverly Root, I don't know anything about him except this quote, but he is my hero.
Oh, that is perfect.
So, my favorite thing about these near beers is that they all ended with the letter O for some reason. So, yeah. Anheuser-Busch developed Bevo. Pabst did Pablo. Bad. Miller Bevo. Did Vivo.
Whoa. Vivo I've heard of.
Schlitz did Famo.
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Youngling did Juvo.
These are terrible names!
They're very bad! I don't know where they came from or why they decided that these were the names. I don't know. I have no explanation or why they all end with O's. I guess it was trendy at the time. These beer companies basically did this to keep in business, but some of them also like went into the ice cream business. You know, they already had the refrigerated trucks.
Okay.
So Youngling, they started dance halls in certain cities, like places where you would go and dance and drink non-alcoholic beer, which sounds like the most Mayberry thing I could possibly think of.
What is it?
Like,
I'm sorry, what's Mayberry?
It's the town Griffin? The Andy Griffith
show. Oh, right, okay, yes, thank you.
Even trying all of these tactics, shockingly, beer companies did not do well during Prohibition.
You don't say.
Mm-hmm. There's a few different estimates on how much lost tax revenue the government suffered because of this from liquor and beer companies. It ranges from several hundred million to a few billion.
Wow. And then
on top of that, to enforce Prohibition, it cost at least like... the estimate I saw, I don't know if it was making dispensation for modern currency or not, but it was between 11 and 86 million to enforce Prohibition.
Wow.
And even that, they didn't do a super good job. So
no, they did not.
Yeah.
Dang.
So this is how the people were preparing for Prohibition. So on the lawmaker side, Prohibition the jurisdiction for enforcement was given to the IRS.
Why?
Because it seemed appropriate?
Okay.
I don't know. It was the Bureau of Prohibition. Strange. Under the Internal Revenue Service. Uh-huh. Later they were like, you know what, we're accountants, maybe we should not do this. And the federal government was right, like, you're right. And they gave it to the Department
of Justice. Wait, are
you
telling me that the IRS took down all those gangsters and stuff? Or was that, like, cops?
I mean...
That's why... Have you watched the Beverly Hillbillies?
Yeah.
That's why when they're up there distilling and the government agents come after them, that's why they say the revenuers are coming.
Oh! Mm-hmm.
That is correct. We'll talk about gangsters and prohibition agents, I think, next time.
Oh, I wanted gangsters, you know.
There will be, don't worry, there will be lots of gangsters. Cool. I have two in particular I'm very excited about.
Speaking of tax revenue, sorry, random fact.
No, go ahead.
I think I've mentioned, a couple months ago I got to tour the Jack Daniel's distillery.
Nice.
And I learned that they pay several million dollars in federal taxes every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, what? So you can make a lot of tax money off of whiskey and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a bad idea for everyone ever involved.
It was a very bad idea. Well,
liquor is much more highly regulated now because of Prohibition. We're going to talk about that a little bit next time, but But, like, that was part of the thing is, like, why are we banning it when we could be regulating it and right. making money? I don't know. It's
interesting.
The Volstead Act ordered federal prohibition agents to be hired, and the IRS hired 1,520 federal prohibition agents.
It's a lot.
For a population of 106 million people.
Okay.
So, other people claimed that they were going to enforce prohibition. The KKK claimed that they would take vigilante action.
Oh, Lord.
They didn't really.
Thank you.
Yeah. The 1920s, they were largely cast into public disgrace, especially after 1925. So they lost whatever vigilante action enforcement they claimed to have over that time. A few months into prohibition, they were having so much trouble enforcing it that the IRS commissioner, Daniel C. Roper, he put a public statement in the Evening Public Ledger in 1920 that said he asked clergymen to keep their congregations accountable by forming law enforcement committees.
Oh, Lord.
Basically, what? That having is the your worst congregation. Idea. Yeah, enforce prohibition.
That is the worst idea.
It was very bad. There's no evidence that any of that actually that? Happened, oh, but good. You know that that happened.
I mean, I could see it. I could see it happening on like a personal level anyway, because it was such a big temperance was such a big social movement. I could see, you know, having the local temperance ladies committee at your church hounding you all the time anyway.
Listen, sweetheart, we're just concerned for you.
Oh, Lord.
Don't let the devil in your house!
So, on top of all of these challenges, federal agents and police suddenly found out that taking bribes was super lucrative.
Oh, Lord.
Yes.
So, yeah. Enforcement was a problem. Okay, so I want to talk about how people got illegal liquor. During the during Prohibition?
Yes, please. And I want share the secrets.
Oh, yes. I want to talk about it mostly because it means I get to talk about poisons again.
Yes. I am here for this.
All right. So, the number one source of alcohol during Prohibition produced for consumption was from denatured alcohol.
Okay, what does that mean?
Okay.
That doesn't sound
so
good.
Alcohol is used in industries. It's used for things like dyes and for fuel production, that kind of thing, right?
Okay.
So, but if you're going to use it industrially, you have to denature it. Basically, you have to add poison to it.
That sounds
awful. Or make it so
awful.
Terribly bitter that no one could drink it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's tough to take these poisons out, but it's not impossible. The best alcohol to renature, as they called it, was perfumer's alcohol because it had to be very pure, so you couldn't add a lot of denaturing elements to it.
Okay, smart.
So, yeah, people loved perfumer's alcohol. It was very easy to make edible alcohol because of that, because of its purity. So, I want to talk about the number one way you denature alcohol, and it's methanol, which is a very good poison. And I say good, and I mean terrible. So, methanol will, in fact, get you drunk. Let's talk about, I guess we should talk chemistry first, right?
Yeah, because I don't know what methanol is.
Right. The alcohol that you drink in liquor is ethanol. It is made of two carbons and some hydrogens and an alcohol group. Okay?
Okay.
Methanol is similar structure, but it is made with one carbon and some hydrogens and an alcohol group.
That makes a big difference?
It does, because if you drink ethanol, then your body turns it into ethyl aldehyde, or ethaldehyde? Acetaldehyde, there we go. It turns it into acetaldehyde.
Wait, that's not
and
good.
Acetate.
I know those things
no,
are
no,
not
no.
good.
Acetaldehyde is not super, like, good for you. It's not a vitamin, for goodness sake. But your body can handle it.
Okay.
Like, your liver filters it out pretty well. Okay? And then acetate, that's just, it's actually an ingredient in vinegar. It's harmless.
Hmm. I was not expecting the word harmless to come up in this conversation.
Well, okay. So, obviously, you drink too much ethanol, you will be harmed and you will die. Okay. Right. But your body has a much better tolerance for it. Now, if you drink methanol, then it turns into formic acid and formaldehyde.
That's very bad.
They're very bad. So, formic acid eats away at your optic nerves. Formaldehyde corrodes your organs.
Mm. Let's just not do either of those things.
Yeah, exactly. So, you basically are blind and then dead after about a quarter cup of methanol.
Oof.
And unfortunately, because... What?
How quickly would you die? Like, would that kill you instantly? Or, like, would it take a bit?
If you drank a quarter cup of methanol, you would be dead before morning.
Okay.
Except in this one really weird case that I heard, they were trying to kill this guy for insurance money, and, like... They tried to poison him 4 or 5 different ways, and he just would not die.
We should do a series on him.
It's kind of amazing. I'll look into that if you like. But
does,
like,
Mithridates it was, know?
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, did anyone tell that king? I couldn't remember his name, though. Good job.
That's wonderful. Mithridates, the answer was here the whole time.
This was Mithridates. He survived. It all paid off in the end.
It all makes sense. It's going to kill you quickly for a poison, but it's not going to be a fun passage. That's
few
for certain.
Things are.
Okay, but if you have just a little methanol, then you do get drunk, but the high doesn't last nearly so long. So methanol was the cheapest way to denature alcohol, so it was everywhere. And because ethanol and methanol are so similar, that was very difficult to remove ethanol from, or I'm sorry, remove methanol from ethanol to make it edible. So basically, if you went to your local gin joint, there was a chance that there were trace amounts of methanol in everything you drank.
Poofed.
Mm-hmm. So if you didn't want to mess with the chemistry, you could always distill your own alcohol.
Yeah, I was about to ask. I always assume that that's what happened for the most part.
Well, it was more common in rural areas where you have space to hide.
Right. Okay.
The denaturing of alcohol, that's a thing that happens, you know, with a chemistry set.
Right.
If you can get a hold of the source of the denatured alcohol on a consistent basis, then you could make yourself a nice little coin if you had a chemistry set and the know-how.
Cool.
And you might probably not kill people, maybe.
Okay, less cool.
That's always a bonus.
So let's talk about home distilled alcohol. So one of the most common ways to make alcohol was to take a bunch of wood chips and shavings and subject them to fermentation.
No.
It was common, but it was very bad, because guess what that gives you? It's not ethanol, it's methanol. That's just straight up methanol. It's extremely bad.
That's the worst.
Yeah, methanol is also known as wood alcohol for that very reason. It's not a good idea.
Do you know how bad that would smell? Just saying. I mean, it would taste awful, too. Sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that some. So another way would be, you know, if you have a little space and you have the right distillery equipment, you make moonshine, whiskey, and rum.
Yay. I don't know why I'm cheering for that. It's just, it's better than wood, you know?
It is not poisonous. Probably. It probably does have a much, much higher alcohol content than, you know, your average vodka. Like, it's extremely, extremely strong alcohol.
Have
it's mostly ethanol.
Ever smelled? You know the term white lightning?
Yeah.
It's the freshly distilled clear whiskey. And again, when I was at the Jack Daniels distillery, they let you smell it for like 2 seconds.
And how'd that go?
You don't really want to smell it for longer.
Yeah. Oh, no. It'll burn your nose hairs right out.
Yep.
Another way you could distill your own alcohol is you just buy up a bunch of grape juice. There were no regulations on grape juice, and if you just leave it for 60 days, it'll ferment all by itself.
Seems legit.
Yeah, it gives you 12% very bad wine.
I mean, it depends on the grapes, I guess.
And no, it does not.
Oh, no.
Yeah, incidentally, the grape juice industry did really well during Prohibition.
Gee.
Mm-hmm. So here's the thing about all of these options, every single one of these options, denatured alcohol, moonshine, you know, grape juice in your shed.
They're all illegal and not worth it.
Well, they are, we're all illegal, but worse than that, they tasted just terrible.
I'm sure.
Like, you ever talk to anyone who makes alcohol? It is an art. Like, you don't make wine by leaving grape juice in a bucket for 60 days. Mm-hmm. You do, technically, but it's not good. Renatured alcohol tasted awful. Moonshine was often way stronger than people were used to, and often made inexpertly, and often terrible. So, the other option is to get alcohol from people who actually know how to make it. So you smuggle it. You smuggle it from over the borders. Yeah. So, incidentally, also, distilleries in Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean did real awesome during
prohibition. Oh, goodness. So, yeah, and one of the ways I want to know, did people just, like, move to Canada?
You know what? I don't think so. I do know that people border hopped just, like, chronically. There were parts of the Canadian border where it was just like, listen, it is not worth it to guard this post because you will be arresting 50 people today. And we have one jail cell. So, yeah, in the same with Mexico, incidentally. The Caribbean was especially popular because, especially along the south coast, a lot of people had boats. So, you know, if you're a fisherman, then it is convenient to hit up your local smuggler.
I know a couple songs about that.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of ways to get a hold of this liquor. You usually had to know a guy who knew a guy. Often that guy that your guy knew was a member of organized crime, especially in the cities.
I mean, if he was a smuggler, then yeah, he was.
Yes, but it wasn't just, you know, we're not talking like a couple of folks. Yeah, it's the mob, y'all. Which I think we'll talk about a little bit more in the next part. I know. I saved all the mob stuff for later. But that's because I really, really, really wanted to talk about speakeasies.
Okay.
Yeah!
I'm
back on board now.
I mentioned that the day before Prohibition, people just got smashed. People were gathered in Times Square, like, to mourn the passage of midnight. They had these parties where they dressed all in black, and they set up a casket, and then you filled the casket with empty beer bottles all night long.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And as soon as midnight struck, you were suddenly a criminal.
No.
For imbibing. So,
but wait, you said it was okay to drink.
As long as they're not buying it after midnight, they're fine.
Yeah. People started getting arrested pretty soon. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Like, day of. I want to talk about the party culture that resulted from Prohibition, because it's some fascinating stuff.
I know what this is. This is your excuse to get us to talk about swing dancing.
Absolutely not. How dare you?
I buy it jazz. Completely. Please
swing
continue.
Swing was 30s and 40s, and I'll fight you.
Okay. Jazz music?
But I will be talking about. I will be talking about jazz music, yes. Cool. But not cool. yet. First, I want to talk about speakeasies. So, there were the term speakeasy comes from the idea, obviously, you gotta speak easy, speak quietly, or you'll get caught.
The first rule
they were also
fight
called.
Club.
Yes, don't talk about. First rule of beer. Drinking gin during Prohibition. Don't talk about drinking gin during Prohibition. So they were also called blind tigers or blind pigs.
What? Why didn't we keep that name?
I know. It's very good, right? It's not as catchy as speakeasies.
No.
Early on,
I'm sorry.
A lot of speakeasies.
I would totally be like, where are you going tonight? I'm going to Blind Tiger.
Heck
guys,
yeah.
Can we start a bar?
Yeah?
Yes.
We're going to start a bar and call it the Blind Tiger. Okay, continue.
Sounds good.
I'm in.
Maybe people will pay us.
Whoa! Novel thought. So, at a speakeasy or a blind tiger, especially early on in Prohibition, there was this air of serious secrecy. So you'd go there and someone would give you, you'd pay a dollar and someone would give you a card. And then you'd take the card inside and put it in a slot, and someone would hand you a martini through the screen, and, like, you never saw the bartender. And that was by design, because they didn't want to get in trouble, obviously.
Okay.
Another tactic was they would set up a little sideshow. Like, see the Greenland... Oh, no, I gotta do old-timey voice, all right?
Yes.
Hello, hello, young whippersnappers. You should see the Greenland pig. 25 cents admission plus a complimentary cocktail. Wink, wink.
I see.
Mm-hmm, because it wasn't illegal to give people liquor.
Wasn't it? That's good.
It's a good tactic. Didn't work all the time. Some speakeasies had a signal light or a watchman who would basically walk in and sound the alarm if anyone was coming with, like, you know, any policemen or if the police were coming or if any prohibition agents were spotted, like, they would turn on a light and everyone would, like, dump their drinks out and, like, serve up some juice or something.
This is sparkling water!
The revenuers are coming!
I would never.
What do you take me for? Someone who drinks alcohol?
Again, they still do this. The Jack Daniel's distillery is in Dry County.
That's what? Amazing.
And that is how you buy the alcohol from the gift shop. You buy the commemorative souvenir bottle, and out of the goodness of their hearts, they fill it with the whiskey of your choice.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is amazing, and I love it.
So, one British guy who came to America to visit... There's just one. A single British man visited America during Prohibition.
And everyone else knew better and stayed away.
They're off in the pubs.
No, but a visiting Brit wrote, every time you go for a drink, there is an adventure. I suppose it adds to one's pleasure to change into a pirate or a dark character entering a smuggler's cave.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't wrong.
He gets it.
This became almost a luxury experience. And that became more and more true as Prohibition went on. Speakeasies became a little more, you know, quote, accepted.
Okay.
Like, they weren't getting raided all the time. And they turned into less of a cloak and dagger, hide in a room, in a dark room where you don't see your bartender, and more like a genuine dance club, an experience and a good time.
Fun.
Mm-hmm. Some of these clubs were integrated, which was super, super unusual.
Nice.
And part of it was by necessity, like you take the clients that you get.
Alcohol brings people together.
but part of it was, it added to the experience, you know, for upper-middle-class white girl to waltz into Harlem and go to a black and tan where she dances with a black guy who she's never, like, talked to before.
Okay.
Yeah, which unfortunately led to some really bad cultural tendencies. The best example of this is the Cotton Club. Now,
which is?
The Cotton Club is the most famous speakeasy of the 1920s. It was a whites-only club in Harlem. But it featured some of the most famous black performers of jazz music of all time.
Oh, dear.
Mm-mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. It's all very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Cotton Club, you could go to the Cotton Club and see people like Cab Calloway, or Chick Webb, or Louis Armstrong, or Count Basie, or Bessie Smith, or Billie Holiday, or Fats Waller, and all of these people are, like, black artists. These are up-and-coming jazz artists that basically the white people go to hear play because you can't hear them anywhere else. Okay. They had celebrity nights on Sundays, which I guess means this is when we have the white people on stage. So people like George Gershwin, Irving Berlin, Al Jolson, Mae West, Judy Garland. Langston Hughes also came to a celebrity night, but he hated the Cotton Club. He thought it was like a zoo.
Oh,
he called
no.
it a Jim Crow club for gangsters and moneyed whites.
Ooh.
Yeah. Langston Hughes dealing out those good burns. Another thing that speakeasies popularized was cocktails.
Were those not popular before?
Not really. They were mixed drinks were like a thing you did for a very, very special occasion, or a thing rich people did for clubs and like country clubs kind of thing. But they were not all that popular with like your average drinker.
Interesting.
Yes. But they became very popular during Prohibition. Do you want to know why?
Yeah, why?
Because
why?
The alcohol tasted terrible.
Oh, so you put it in with, like, fruit juice or something.
Exactly. So, Smart. Lot of the, a lot of popular cocktails that we know and love today were developed and popularized in the 1920s. An Old Fashioned, that became popular. Highball, a sidecar was invented. And there are a few of them that I just particularly like, so I'm going to tell you about them. There's one called the Bee's Knees.
yes.
Exactly. It sounds like the thing you drink when your throat is sore, except instead of tea, it's gin, lemon juice, and honey.
Gin, lemon juice, and... Okay, sorry. It took me a second to understand that that was the recipe.
Yeah. This is a good one. There's a cocktail called the French 75, which was named after a gun. And that was gin, lemon juice, simple syrup, and either dry champagne or sparkling wine.
Ooh.
It's very fancy.
You're making me want to try some of these.
Yeah, then there's one called the Mary Pickford. It was named after an actress who was known as America's Sweetheart, even though she was Canadian.
Okay.
One is, this sounds very good. White rum, pineapple juice, maraschino liqueur, and is it grenadine?
Yes, please.
So I
Anna,
mentioned
you're
this
making
before
me thirsty.
The Cotton Club. Anyone for a drink? Not me. I don't drink.
I'll drink yours.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll split yours.
I touched on this before, but. Another important result of Prohibition was the popularization of jazz music.
Cool.
Okay, which I need to specify for you, Rissa, and also for my own peace of mind.
Okay.
Jazz music was popular was popularized between 1915.
Okay.
Was when it started to get put in the public eye, and the late 1920s, early 1930s.
Okay.
Swing music was from the early 1930s to, I guess you could call it the early 50s.
And those things are different things.
They're
and
different
I definitely
things.
Knew that. Mm-hmm.
They're not that different. They are closely related musical genres. But the culture that follows both of them were very, very different.
Okay.
Swing music was almost respectable.
And jazz music was the opposite of that.
Oh, it was very much not. It was definitely thought of as a guilty pleasure alongside the illegal liquor. Like, you know how in the 50s people are like, rock and roll is devil music?
Yeah.
That was the same kind of vibe that jazz music had. I actually found an article in a 1921 edition of Ladies' Home Journal called "Does Jazz Put the Sin in Syncopation?"
What?
Well,
oh gosh.
Does it?
It's funny you mentioned that because if you've ever listened to later jazz and very early rock and roll, you can definitely hear some style overlap.
Yeah, and that's not just jazz, that's also swing.
It's also swing.
Well,
but,
I'll get there. Jazz music was born of ragtime, which was a very, very much an African American art form that was influenced by gospel, folk, and Latin music too, as well as some very interesting African drum beats. So it's a mostly classical sounding sort of thing, but to everyone else, it sounded completely different than anything they had ever listened to. If you listen to Bach and then you listen to ragtime, you kind of get an idea of how people were thinking of this new and exciting form of music. And then that turned into jazz, where you add the improvisation and the band and the personalities and alongside that, the speakeasy culture. Jazz started getting popular as people moved from country to city. It was like almost a cultural enrichment thing. Is like, what's the hip new thing that the kids are listening to? It's jazz. It also caught on because of the introduction of commercial radio stations. Suddenly, you know, there were stations that weren't owned by the government or for public service or whatever. They were just owned by folks who wanted to play music for people to hear. And what people wanted to hear was jazz. So suddenly, you could hear not only the music that you played or that your friends played, and not just a music on a record, which you may or may not be able to afford, but also music on the radio, which was basically free, and suddenly you had access to this whole wide world of music. I definitely think that jazz, especially as it was introduced mostly in speakeasies, was the beginning of this weird cultural thing we Americans have of that black culture is cool culture.
Okay, mm-hmm. Interesting. Sorry, I'm still just processing the idea that they didn't always play music on the radio. I guess I kind of, like, knew that, but it seems weird.
Well, think of it like this. Radio was mostly used in World War I for military purposes, right?
Right. I just never thought about it that way.
Mm-hmm. The idea of a commercial radio station, I want to look into that because I don't know anything about the history of commercial radio stations, but, like, I love the idea of some guy saying, okay, so, get this. I'm going to play some records that I have. And then I'm going to ask, like, the local butcher shop if he wants me to say his name and talk about his butcher shop in between the records. And I'll make money that way, and the music will be free. What do you think, Frank? So, jazz music was the entertainment thing that was dispensed in speakeasies. And because of that, they were heavily associated with each other. So, suddenly this very African-American art form was associated with a little bit of risk, a little bit of danger, but also being very, very cool. And this has kind of continued to resonate throughout our cultural purview. Like, I think that if pop culture wants to know what's cool, it looks to African-American people to see what they're up to and then just steals it.
Hmm.
So, and this is very much the same thing with jazz, even though it was an African-American developed art form. White artists doing covers of black artists' songs consistently outsold black artists.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sucks. But because of the spread of jazz, almost all modern music owes something to jazz.
Makes sense.
I would actually, you know what? I would say all modern music owes something to jazz.
Yeah?
Yeah, like every musical genre has its roots in jazz. All of them. Fight me.
I don't want to fight you.
Okay, good.
At least not before the cocktail.
Look, we already know that Hannah would beat me in a fight. Let's be real here.
I did once.
Yep, you did
there
once.
There were swords.
Uh-huh.
I was in a dress. It was great.
It was pretty
the
epic.
The hardest moment of my life.
It was very good.
I think I could take you.
Take, okay.
Cleo, take me or Rissa?
My
money's
one.
On science.
Either one.
I mean, for taking me, I'd probably bet on you. But for taking science, I'd bet on science.
Nope. I think I could do
it. I like
it.
This, I'm interested to know how. Like, I'm really curious. I kind of want to fight you just for, like, academic purposes at this point.
For academic purposes.
So along with jazz music came dancing, and these brand new dance styles were invented. The most popular during the 20s were the Charleston, the Lindy Hop, and the Black Bottom. No, Rissa, none of those count as swing dancing.
Okay, the Lindy Hop sounds exactly like a swing dance thing.
No, okay, swing dancers like to do the Lindy Hop, but, and they do it, the Lindy Hop to swing music, it fits real nice, but it was born in the 20s, it's a jazz dance.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
So, in the same way as modern dancing emphasizes butts,
where is the lie, though?
Yeah, really. These dance forms emphasized arms and legs, because suddenly ladies were wearing very short skirts, and they didn't have sleeves all the way down to their wrists anymore. The Victorian fashion was no longer very fashionable, and so anything to show off the length of your long white arms and legs was extremely scandalous and extremely hilarious to watch.
Elbows.
Have you ever seen someone doing the Charleston?
I
know you guys have seen
me
doing it. It's ridiculous.
Just elbows flying everywhere.
Mm-hmm. The Black Bottom was particularly scandalous because it had you moving your hips as well as your arms and legs. Oh, I know.
Alcohol and elbows. What is America coming to?
The point of all of this is that speakeasy culture made drinking into this big, secret, wicked thing that was very cool, but very illegal. And, you know, culturally speaking, people were kind of looking to forget because this had been just after World War I, which was a long and horrible war that, well, you know, World War II, it's easy to see why we fought, you know, against tyranny. World War I did not have the advantage of having a clear bad guy, so there was a lot of,
Or a clear reason why America was involved.
Exactly. So there's, you know, people wanted to forget the horrible things that they had said. And, you know, everyone had money, there was economic surplus, there were all these new things to hear and see and do, you know. The party culture thrived, and so did alcohol use, and shockingly, that means that more people broke the law. So people were arrested for buying alcohol, for making alcohol. So there were a lot of arrests. And usually, unfortunately, it wasn't rich people who were arrested. It was poor people. Because poor people couldn't pay bribes. And because poor people were easy to prosecute. And because poor people wouldn't make a big stink about party culture and you know, but everyone goes to the speakeasy once in a while.
Right.
You know, so,
oof, this is getting ugly.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there was, although the speakeasy was kind of a class leveler, you basically could go to the speakeasy if you had the money for it.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't very likely to be arrested if you had, anything at your disposal, any kind of resources at your disposal.
Right.
Which means that the other thing that this led to was a rise in organized crime. Because, you know, if the cops are going to prosecute you for distilling liquor, then you look to someone who can protect you.
So okay.
We'd say, like Al Capone.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So that's what part three is going to be like. We're going to talk about bad guys and good guys and whether or not those guys were on the same side.
Mm.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of my favorite personalities from Prohibition.
Nice.
There are some characters.
That sounds very fun.
Oh, yeah. And then we'll talk about the end of Prohibition and the cultural impacts, the kind of stuff we're still feeling today. So, yeah.
That sounds
that
fun.
That has been part two of my tourist guide to Prohibition. I'm going to down this tea and not speak anymore. My throat is so
raw. Oh, no.
Is there a recipe book for these cocktails that can be made with good alcohol and not, like, shoe polish?
There are some excellent guides on the internet if you are interested. I could send you a couple of them. Or we could post a couple of them, if you like, along with the snail teeth.
I really just want you to post a video of these dance styles.
We can do that too.
I think the snail teeth should come first though, because everyone's gonna want a recipe for a drink after looking at that.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. So I think now's a good time to move into post-grad problems. Rissa, do you have one for us?
Yeah, I've been debating a little bit how to describe this, because it's this odd time management problem. And this is a problem that's not so much post-grad as post-grad and I don't have a job yet problem.
Oh no,
so
please,
you guys might not have to deal with this problem, but if you're listening and you've ever spent a couple months unemployed looking for work, that kind of thing, you might get this, because it's like, at once I have significantly too much time on my hands and also have a cramped schedule. And it's weird, because what happens is, if I want to do anything with anyone else, I have to do it in the evening, like we are doing right now. All of my social events have to be planned for after normal work hours. But I don't have a job or anything to do with that huge portion of my day where all of my friends are working. And so
it's like every evening you're busy and every day.
Every evening I'm busy and every day I just have to figure out how to spend my time. And I mean, I've got a couple of projects going, and I'm watching all of Xena Warrior Princess, and I mean, I have things to do. I have a couple video games I haven't even touched yet, but I don't know, it's getting really cabin fever. I mean, it's made me go to the gym a bit, which is good, but I don't know. Especially what happens is it gets to about the middle of the afternoon, and it's just like, oh, I gotta do something. I've actually taking walks after dark just because it's still too hot here to take them in the middle of the day without needing a shower. just to walk around outside my house, you know? Yeah. I've been really struggling with that. Because, like I said, it's like, I have so much time to fill. But then as soon as someone asks me to do something, it's like, oh, I don't have a lot of time. Because they need to do it either on a weekend or in an evening. That kind of thing. And it's not so like the all my weekends and like... evenings are filled. I mean, that's not as big of a problem. It is a little bit of a problem when everyone wants to do everything on weekends. And when I say people do things, let's be frank. 90% of this is Skype stuff. Because most of my friends I have really only contact with online. Because like you guys, they're not in the same city as me. But yeah, so that's my, like, new time management problems. I knew I had time management problems in college, but that was like a, I have so much work to do that I'm not doing. And now it's this almost surplus of one portion of time and then not enough of another. It's been odd. I actually had a couple of phone interviews this week, thank God. And one of them was like, why do you want this job? And I mean, I had a couple good reasons, but then it was like, you know, it's just, I need a job. I need something to do with my time that pays me. You know, like, why they always ask that question, why do you want this job? And you're like, because I want to get paid.
She tells them that? Because
I
need a job.
I mean, no, not in those words, but, like, it was actually a really good interview. It was very relaxed, and so, yeah, I was basically like, I mean, I like the place, and I need something to do with my time that someone will pay me for. So.
I do understand what you mean, because you guys didn't know me at this point, because it was the year before I came to JBU, but I lost my job. And I was unemployed for a few months, and it was terrible. I had this moment where I was like, this is why old men who lose their factory jobs just all sit on the front porch of a gas station and drink and gripe about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It made me honestly be like, oh, this is why people don't retire.
Yeah. It got to the point where I bought myself a book on cleaning house.
Oof.
I bought, like, house cleaning for dummies.
Oh, you are far gone.
And came up with a scientific method for sorting my laundry and a bathroom cleaning schedule.
Wow. Okay, wow. That's bad.
It was bad.
Now, I've never been that bored in my life. I will clean the kitchen, but I'll mostly do it as kind of, like, I've got time, it'll make mom happy, so I'll clean the kitchen. But I've never been so bored that I bought a book and sorted laundry special ways.
Yeah, but it was one of those things where it was like,
I have Xena to fill that hole.
I needed to feel like I was doing something productive, and coming up with a schedule for cleaning the kitchen sink made me feel productive.
Like I said, I found a couple projects. I'm hoping to go to a Comic Con, and so I'm working on a couple of outfits for that. And once again, I'm about halfway through a 6-season TV show at this point. Very steadily doing that. But I don't know. Especially, I think I need something more physical to do. Once again, some of this is being fulfilled by going to the gym, but I don't go every day, so I don't know, guys.
This is a problem I cannot...
Yeah, well, and the other feeling is that whatever I do right now to, like, create a system or whatever, as soon as I get a job, that system will either have to go away or be vastly adjusted. So at this point, because I finally got at least a couple of phone interviews to set up normal interviews, I don't want to start committing to things. Because hopefully I'll have a job soon.
So let's see. Is there something you can fill your time with that is, like, physical and productive, but also something you can drop if you need to?
Yeah, I don't know.
community basketball.
Nope.
You need to do.
Listen, I just really like the image of you playing community basketball.
You need to go and find like a test session of goat yoga.
What? No.
Or that thing where you do like aerobic air drumming.
What?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's, they give you weighted drumsticks and they play music and they lead you, like, you pretend like you're drumming.
I have seen
in
a video
time
of
to
this.
The music. I kind of.
Yeah, so I am, I have this
so
thing.
So it's like
that
Zumba meets
I
weightlifting.
I really
yeah.
dislike
plus airband.
Group exercise classes. Something about group exercise classes, I just kind of hate them.
Oh no, I hate them too. Cool, I feel like I'm being watched. I know I'm not, yeah. And I know that everyone else feels the same way, uh-huh. But still.
I think just do not like them at all.
He used to have a hip-hop workout video, but it whistled at me.
Ew.
It whistled at
it
you?
It did. It was just randomly go.
Bad design.
In the middle of the
ew.
Workout.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Hey, wait a second, wait a second, wait a mm-mm. second. Cleo, can you not whistle?
No.
What? Okay. 911, we're gonna emergency whistling thing. Do we need to teach you how to whistle?
Everyone has tried to teach me how to whistle. I could try it.
Do it.
Give it a shot.
That, what is that? That's a throat noise. Whistling is a mouth noise.
It's so good.
I tried, okay. I get points for trying.
You succeeded in my heart. Oh. Oh, gosh. We can't fix your post-grad problem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Rissa.
I know. Maybe that's what I should do with my time, is just get better at whistling.
Whistle but while yeah. you don't work. Just whistle while you don't work.
We don't have anything in particular that we're into this week. But our dear listener, JD, sent us... What? Okay, yeah, all right, fine. We don't have anything that we're into this week that we haven't already talked about, nerd. But our dear listener, JD, sent in a very interesting link to something called the Ig Nobel Awards.
Yeah, it was very funny. See, when he first linked to them, I definitely thought it was going to be like the Darwin Awards, but it's better than that.
So the Darwin Awards, they reward stunning acts of stupidity, yes?
Mm-hmm. That often, they have to be those acts of stupidity that end in death.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
So what's the difference between them and the Ig Nobel Awards?
Ig Nobel Awards have a lot more creativity, I think, and they don't often involve dying. So the Darwin Awards are named the Darwin Awards because they are rewarding stupid people for taking themselves out of the gene pool. And that's why they have to end in death. Whereas the Ig Nobel Awards are more for, like, I don't know, a lot of these are fun inventions that, like, why would you make this? But it's a little clever and that kind of thing.
JD, you gave us something to be into, and for that we are perpetually grateful.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're amused and delighted by this submission.
I'm
so
trying to go
you.
Find some of my, because they have, like, a lot of different little things. They, like the Nobel Prizes, they have categories. Physics, economics, chemistry, medicine, that kind of thing. One of them is about a guy who lived as a goat for a while. Why?
As you do.
I don't know, to learn about goats?
Animal behavior study? Wildlife biologists are weird.
One of them is a medicine... one of them is a medicine paper about people who don't like cheese, you know? So it's real crazy stuff. Some of them are inventions, a lot of them are academic papers.
Yeah, so we also like to thank Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech, who did our music, and Caitlin Thompson, who is at this moment a globetrotter, for doing our
Caitlin, come back, we miss you.
Of the actual,
we miss you, Caitlin.
Globe.
Come back to where there's data.
Of the actual globe variety and not the basketball variety.
Also,
yeah,
the globe theater variety.
But thank you to Caitlin for our graphics and design work, and thank you to you for listening. Rissa, do you know what next our next colloquium is going to be?
Last time I started talking about Christianity in art made by non-Christians, and I'm going to continue that, but instead of doing any kind of high and mostly recognized art, we're going to talk about my favorite thing, video games.
Yay.
Specifically, the Dragon Age video game series and Chantry.
I love it when you talk about something you're an expert in.
Me too.
I wouldn't say expert, but I certainly have a lot to say on the matter.
I cannot wait to hear it.
Sounds like
alright, well, until then, we can't wait to talk with you guys, our listeners, again. And until next time, learn something worth knowing.